Welcome to Unit 9, in which we'll take a deeper dive into the concept of a patient safety culture and the ways in which HIT can support and enhance this culture. In this first segment, Dr. Peter Pronovost will share his very successful bloodstream infection story. The principles underlying the success of this initiative are universal and illustrate how you, as a future HIT professional, can help to infect a patient safety culture. By the end of this unit, you'll be able to apply QI tools to the analysis of HIT errors.
Thank you, everybody. You know, when I got that Genius Award, my daughter's teacher brought in the newspaper article and said, "Oh, look, class, Emma's daddy got the Genius Award." And my daughter, as only a kid can say, "What are you talking about? My daddy's not a genius. I put peanut butter on his nose and our big yellow lab licks it off his face. What genius would do that?" And one of the themes you're going to hear me talk about this morning is humbleness. And it's a commodity that is, I think, too rare in our organization. But frankly, without it, you can't get started and you certainly can't progress on this journey. So let's keep that in mind. Now, what I want to do in our time together is really three key things. One is I want to delve into briefly the story of the checklist so you understand this really phenomenal success story, but it's not as simple as the media build it out to be. Second is to understand this thing of culture and what do we mean by that. And then third, and perhaps most of our time, talking about what you can do to prevent projects from failing. Because if we look at our success at implementation of quality and safety products, not just here, but frankly around the globe, we have a batting average of around 10%. Most of them fail, and we need to dig into why that is, and perhaps you may be surprised at some of those reasons. So let me begin with this remembering. Some of you may remember that first Apollo mission that circumnavigated the globe. Well, one of the astronauts on that mission, Randy Schnechter, when he was flying over the Middle East, asked what it was like to look at the Middle East from outer space. And his words, I think, were so telling. He said, "There's no lines from outer space. We invent them. They're figments of our imagination. And yet, on Earth, we kill people over those lines." Right? And I think about our efforts in this country to improve safety over the last decades. And I see efforts that have been competitive more than cooperative. Right? We have about 30 different agencies doing work, and none of them talk to each other. I see efforts that have been independent rather than independent. Even within our own hospitals, we have silos who are working, who are duplicating efforts, and we're not leveraging it. Most importantly, we have efforts that have been focused on what we do, the efforts, rather than results we achieve. Some of you may have read that National Healthcare Quality Report, which is the scorecard, if you will, of how we're doing on quality and safety in this country that was released by ARC, maybe 2 months ago. And the bottom line is, over the last decade, we're doing a lot. We're doing a lot of rah-rah session. We may be using evidence-based medicine more, but the empiric evidence that patients are dying less or that outcomes have actually improved is virtually non-existent. Now, some of that is because we don't have good measures. A lot of it's because we actually haven't improved outcomes, and we need to rethink why that is. Now, one different and remarkable success story is with central line infection. So let's begin with that story a little bit to understand what happened. The Johns Hopkins Hospital, and Judy well knows this, back in the early 2000, 2001, had amongst the highest bloodstream infection rates in the country. We had a rate, which my own belief now is we should have been shut down if we had that rate now, of somewhere around 11 per 1,000 catheter days. It was exceedingly high. And at the time, all of our docs said, "Hey, we treat sick patients. That's the way it is. These infections are inevitable. There's nothing we're going to do about it. We're trying hard." But we questioned that. We said, "Well, are we really doing the best we could? And we went to the Centers for Disease Control, who had a guideline on this, a guideline which, as you know, is the normal way medicine summarizes evidence, that was 200 pages long and had 100 or so recommendations to use. Now, any of you who are clinical will know you're not doing 100 things when you're a busy doctor or nurse or pharmacist on the wards. So we had the perhaps ludicrous idea of taking that guideline and culling out from it a checklist, a list of 5 items that are unambiguous, that are actually doable, and that are probably the most important things. And admittedly, we shot from the hip in picking what was most important, but we got some clinicians who are trained in clinical research to look at the evidence. And we ended up with 5 simple things. Wash your hands, clean your skin with chlorhexidine, avoid placing catheters in the groin, use full barrier precautions, and ask every day if you still need the catheter. Now, when we looked, we saw our docs were doing those things 30% of the time. 30% of the time. Unbelievable. And so we got into a heated argument where our doc said, Peter, these rates are what they're going to be. We have sick people. I said, okay, let's not argue about how low the rates can go, but let's make sure that every patient gets these 5 evidence-based things, because we all agree we ought to be doing these, and let's just see what happens. So they said, okay, great. So we dug into it as applying the science of safety. And one of the principles of the science of safety is standardizing care. And when we looked at why we weren't doing it, we initially fell into the traditional bad doc, bad nurse. If we whip our docs harder, they'll start doing it. But what we found was our docs had to go to 8 different places to get the equipment needed to comply with that checklist. So caps were in one place, masks were in another, gowns were in another. It was no wonder why they didn't comply, because like many of you, our docs were busy. And if they had to walk down the hall to get equipment, that was 5 minutes that they wouldn't spend with another patient. And in their mind, and perhaps logically for a utilitarian approach, they said, it's not worth it. If I'm going to take away from another patient, I'm just going to go without the supply, right? But we should have never put them in that position. So we said, okay, let's get a line cart, right? We'll take 8 steps down to 1. We tried it in the SICU and WICU, as many of you know, and that took compliance from 30% up to 70, 75%. Good, but not good enough. Our rates came down from somewhere around 11 to maybe 5 or so. We said, okay, that's great, but docs aren't still doing it all the time. Let's apply the second principle of the science of safety, which is independent checks. So we pulled the doctors and nurses together and said, nurses, I would like you to assist with the doctors placing a catheter and ensure that they comply with these 5 steps on the checklist. And some of our WICU nurses and SICU nurses are here. You would have thought I caused World War III with that. Now, this was a few years ago, but the culture just didn't allow questioning physicians. And the responses from the docs and nurses were so interesting, which is this culture nugget. The nurses said, hey, it's not my job to police the docs, and if I do, I'm going to get my head bit off. You know, it was fascinating. The view of their scope of authority was, perhaps I feel comfortable advocating for psychosocial issues, but not evidence-based practice or safety, and likely a really real and strong history of it not being safe to speak up, because getting their head bit off is probably a daily occurrence in many of our areas. The docs, on the other hand, were equally interesting. They pulled me aside and said, Peter, there is no way you could have a nurse question me in public. It makes me look like I don't know something, right? And what was driving it was this myth that they have to be perfect. Right? They didn't debate the evidence. They didn't debate, should we do this? What they debated was, is it okay for someone to question me, for me to not be perfect? Right? Fascinating psychology. So I pulled everyone together and said, is it tenable that we harm patients at Johns Hopkins? And everyone said no. And without going into the psychological literature, there's very good evidence that having people publicly commit to a goal dramatically increases adherence to it. I then said, and do you agree that the items on this checklist are sound, that every patient ought to get them? And they said, yes. And I said, then if we agree on that, how could we possibly allow a patient not to get it because of either ego or afraid of speaking up? So nurses, I need you to speak up. Your patients need you to speak up. As a patient advocate, you have to speak up. And doctors, we have permission to make mistakes. I'm going to forget, you're going to forget. We have permission to not remember to wash our hands. But we don't have permission to needlessly put patients at risk. So if we forget it, it's okay. But if a nurse sees you or whoever that check sees you, you got to go back and fix it because we can't put patients needlessly at risk. That, remarkably, I mean, it almost sounds like fairy dust. And indeed, many of the visitors who came to our hospital to see would walk around the WICU or the SICU and said, this culture seems like you sprinkled fairy dust, Peter. People are working together. Is it really real? I said, yeah, go watch it. The interaction isn't confrontational. I think it's because we changed the focus on whether I'm right or you're right to the aligning as the patient as a North Star. We finally realized that rather than battling each other, we're actually on the same team. And this idea of battling, you know, is far too common. I think some of you may have known. I was doing anesthesia a while ago, and I thought one of the patients had a pneumonia. And so he wanted to get a chest x-ray, and it caused an uproar amongst the surgeon who was doing the case, who said, you know, this is nuts. The patient doesn't have a pneumonia. What are you thinking? You know, I said, yeah, I'm an intensivist. I diagnose pneumonia, you know, many times a week. I know what pneumonia is. I think they have it. And then went on to say, you know, this is just you anesthesiologists want to go home early. You're making me late for clinic. And this is all in front of the patient, right? And completely inappropriate. And so after we had a discussion about it afterwards, to the credit, the surgeon apologized to me. But his framing of it was so telling. What he said to me is, you know, Peter, I didn't mean to offend you. I had said, you know, your remarks are completely offensive and inappropriate. But in the heat of battle, you have to exaggerate. And I said, wow, that's a fascinating worldview, because I never thought we were battling. I actually thought we were on the same team. And it's remarkable. I think so much of our conflicts, we actually forget that we are on that same team. Okay, so compliance now, nurses are questioning docs. We're up to about 95% compliance with the checklist, and our rates come down to maybe 2.5 or 3. Just remarkable, remarkable success. Doctors still say there's no way we can get any lower. We said, well, I'm not sure about that. Let's apply the third principle of the science of safety, which is learn from every defect. So we said, let's start investigating each of these infections that we have to see if we can understand why. Now, that approach does two things. Perhaps most importantly, it changes the mental model from these are inevitable to these are preventable, right? Because once we start labeling them as defects, people dig into it and say, okay, well, they shouldn't happen. Let's look into it and why. And secondly, you find out what went wrong. So what did we find out? Well, when we dug into this, we found that, and Deb Hobson helped lead a lot of these investigations, many of the infections, indeed half, weren't from lines that we placed in the ICU. They were from lines that were placed in the operating room. We knew that because the infection developed very quickly within 2 days in the ICU, and they didn't get a new catheter placed. But we hadn't at the time taken the intervention to the operating rooms. So now we had some evidence. We went to the anesthesia leaders and said, hey, you need to start using this approach in the operating room. We have pretty good data that half of the infections that we have are from the catheters that you're placing. We then, rates came down to maybe 2, 1.8. We kept digging in further. And what did we find? And again, this was really our nursing leaders found that the few infections that we had now had nothing to do with the checklist, which is for placing the catheter. It had to do with how we maintain the catheter, because the infections didn't happen within the first 5 days, is what you'd expect if it's due to insertion. They happened after people had catheters for 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks sometime. In other words, it had not likely to do with our checklist, but when we audited our catheter maintenance practices, what we found, and surprisingly, we hadn't standardized, so there was wide variation in knowledge of what we do for catheter maintenance. There was wide variation in practice, and it's hard. Many of the catheters are falling off. The dressings don't stick. So we, again, mostly collaborating with nursing, got new dressings that actually stay on at IJ much better. Deb Hobson and others developed in-services to audit our catheter maintenance so that each day we would look to see are the dressings intact, and we trained or rechained the nursing staff to make sure they do it. And with that, we virtually eliminated these infections. Now, when I say that, let me just frame this performance to you, because it's truly breathtaking, this mindset of switching inevitable to preventable. What we found was that the cardiac SICU, which the average patient has three or so catheters, had gone over a year. I think it went to like 72 weeks without an infection. The SICU, Deb, you can correct me, I think at a time went 85 weeks. The WICU was up to 88 or so weeks, all with, I mean, unheard of performance. Now, is that really eliminating them because after 85 weeks you get an infection? The reality is, I don't know. But my gut is if you can go over a year without an infection, I suspect the one we have is we probably got sloppy. I don't know that for sure. Maybe the patient was that sick, but and they were in it, destined to get it, because there are certainly patients at high risk. But that performance was just deemed unheard of. Now, that effort, and then the subsequent effort, where some of you may be aware of, we took this program and put it in the whole state of Michigan and remarkably got the same results as Michigan, essentially eliminated infections in over 100 ICUs. I mean, I was petrified to think of scaling up a safety program that could be scaled up and made that simple to implement in hospitals that we have absolutely no relationship with. But the reality is it worked, and we published that in New England Journal. We then went on to do the same thing in Rhode Island. That will be published shortly. Every hospital in the state eliminated. We're now, which is near killing me, putting it in every state in the country. We've launched about 50 states, or we've launched about 38 states, and I think 44 have signed up. But within 6 months, Hawaii eliminated these infections. About 75% of the hospitals in Ohio have signed up, eliminated these infections. The half the hospitals in New Jersey signed up, eliminated these infections. Half of the hospitals in Georgia signed up, eliminated infections. I mean, it's remarkable that this model works. So what is this model? Well, I wish I can tell you I understand it really deeper of what happened, but I don't. But I know that it's not just the checklist that the press says it is. And the reason why I know that is when we went to go to take this outside to other hospitals, I hear some very common things. I hear, oh, we're using the checklist. And I say, great, yeah, but the public really cares about your infection rates. I don't really care about the checklist. What are they? And uniformly, the answer is we either don't know or our rates are high. But most importantly, it's the question, the responses I get when I talk to nurses. And I think this is perhaps the most indicting statement of our medical culture. In every hospital I've been at, quite frankly, except ours, and we'll talk about that in a second, when I ask the nurses in that hospital, if you were to see a doctor, and especially a senior doctor, putting a catheter and not complying with the checklist, would you speak up, and do you think the doctor would comply? And literally in every hospital in this country, I'm laughed at as if I'm nuts. The nurses say, are you crazy, Peter? There is no way we have that culture to support it. Now I want you to think back for a second. Now, just take a step back. Nobody debates the evidence, right? And the use of this darn thing, I mean, saved probably 20,000 lives this year. Right? 31,000 people die from central line-associated bloodstream infections. It's a high, high mortality of all of our central line infections. And we tolerate a culture where we wantonly allow failure to comply with evidence-based standards because of, frankly, ego, right? I mean, I don't know any other industry, where we would tolerate 31,000 deaths a year when you have a solution because of this cultural barrier. To me, it's unconscionable, a leadership failure in our American medical system to not create that kind of culture. To put this into context for you, how many of you have seen the Toyota's CEO's apology on TV? You obviously see that? Yeah. So that got, you know, a week's frontline attention of all the national newspapers, of CNN all the time. You know how many people died from that brake problem? Does anyone know? Got a lot of attention. 4 per year for 5 years. 4. 20 patients total died, and the CEO of Toyota was on national television publicly apologizing for it. Right? 31,000 people die each year from these infections. And we know from your good work here that they're entirely preventable. And yet, we tolerate a culture where around the country, nurses routinely say, not only is it not possible, I'm laughed at. I mean, it's so extreme that they truly laugh. They say, you must be crazy, Peter. What planet do you live on? Now, let me tell you what culture we achieved here with this, and we'll go into how we did that.
So that was Peter's BSI story. Key points for you to remember include, despite massive efforts, healthcare quality and safety have not significantly improved. It takes teamwork and cooperation to achieve lasting improvement. There have been pockets of success, most notably with respect to national efforts to improve central line bloodstream infection rates. Keys to success in that initiative have been three of the science of safety principles: standardization, independent checks, and learning from every defect.